This is Leslie Nichols speaking from Okinawa. During the past few days, while the nation has mourned the loss of its executive head and fighting leader, we in the Pacific have been permitted to tell the story of what has been going on out here. A story which Franklin Delano Roosevelt knew all about. It is the story of a mad, ruthless band of Oriental despots who, in deliberately sacrificing human life side by side with shells and bombs, have sought to stave off their doom. Probably nothing like this has occurred since the Middle Ages. One searches the memory to recall anything in the history of the last 200 years that approaches the degradation and shame which the Japanese militarists, running riot in their desperation, have heaped upon the Japanese people as a whole. There is another story, too. It is the story of the men of the United States Navy, who for 6 months have fought this barbaric threat with valor and skill and devotion, as have no other men fought in the history of naval warfare. It was from this second story that President Roosevelt, the greatest Navy president the country ever had, must have derived consummate satisfaction. It was the president's foresight that enabled us to begin our building program long before Pearl Harbor. It was the president's insistence that nothing be spared in providing the finest ships, the most modern devices, and the best base facilities as we began the long push across the Pacific to Tokyo. It remained to be seen whether, with all these material advantages, our fighting men could pass the supreme test of unflinching fortitude in combat. The Japs, in their unwitting lack of perspective, provided the test. The Kamikaze Corps was created to deal with our Navy. Aside from a few isolated earlier instances involving Jap suicide plane attack, the real trial began in earnest with our invasion of Lady Island in the Philippines last October. Since then, the enemy has hailed hundreds, perhaps thousands, of planes and airmen directly at our ships. Fleet Admiral Nimitz, wisely seeing the advantage in awaiting development of these tactics, advised that no public mention be made of enemy suicide efforts. There were many correspondents, including myself, who felt this decision was wrong. We had experienced the kamikaze attack. We thought we recognized their basic futility. Moreover, we were thrilled at the way in which our American men and boys had responded in fighting back. The heroism of our sailors and airmen in combating the Jap suiciders was the answer to the final question concerning our Navy. Did we have men to man our ships? Furthermore, we correspondents felt that if only the public knew what our Navy was enduring out here, then nothing would check the American people in their wrath and indignation. Nothing would stop our nation in punishing the Japs for employing these caveman tactics. Tactics which denied the very basis of our ethical concept. But Fleet Admiral Nimitz was more realistic. Let's see how far the enemy will go, he counseled. And if the Japs continue the suicide tactics, let's devise the best counter methods to nullify the attempt. But in the meantime, he said, let's keep quiet and give them a minimum of rope. It was a fast carrier force, first under Vice Admiral Mischer, then under Vice Admiral McCain, and now again under Admiral Mischer. The kamikaze attack. There is nothing quite so inviting as the great broad flight deck of an Arctic-class carrier. The Japs knew our carriers were responsible for whittling down their air power. Thus, at the outset, they directed their suicide units to concentrate on our flat tops. Large-scale suicide activity got underway several days following the Lady landings on October the 20th. My own first experience with the Jap kamikaze planes came on November the 25th of last year. I was aboard the Essex-class carrier flagship with Vice Admiral McCain. He had pushed the carrier's coast to the east coast of Luzon, and from there our pilots were making routine strikes against airfields up and down the island. At about noon, all ships in the force were brought to general quarters. Almost immediately, a Jap plane appeared directly above the force. It broke off into a steep dive at about 8,000 feet. The gunners opened fire.
40 millimeters were joined by shorter range 20 millimeter batteries, while 25 inch mounts sent up heavy bursts.
Of all the caves in the forest, and there were, and are many of them, this Jap had picked out the flagship. In a matter of seconds, the enemy hurtled down from 8 to 2,000 feet, traveling at close to 450 miles an hour. Then, one of our 5-inch shells burst near him, knocking out his controls. But the powerful downward thrust kept the enemy on course toward our flight deck. Then, when the Jap was about 800 feet above us, another 5-inch shell caught him squarely. The nip blew to pieces. The force of the 5-inch shell was so great that the heaviest portion of the plane, the engine, was deflected just enough to splash into the water off the starboard bow. The bomb, shaken loose by the concussion, landed harmlessly about 40 feet off the port beam. A portion of the green-colored fuselage plummeted straight down on the flight deck amidships. A shorn-off wing containing a fuel tank struck the flight deck forward. Gas exploded and spread on the deck, but the firefighters had the blaze out in less than 3 minutes. And as for the Jap pilot, someone saw him drop in the water, a dead duck. Save for a few blackened flight deck planks, the carrier was unscathed. Miraculously, no one was scratched. Within the next half hour, four other suicide planes broke through the air defense screen. Two of them, making quick rolls, landed on a major unit. One of these carried a heavy bomb, which penetrated the superstructure deck and exploded on the deck above the armored box, which protects the ship's vitals. The ensuing fire was grave, and the crew fought 2 hours before extinguishing it. Great clouds of black smoke and columns of flame seethed upward. Not once did that proud ship and her gallant crew lose position in the formation or slow down the force of sea. The most intricate evasive maneuvers were executed, for the fleet was still under attack. And the skipper and his men fought the fire with such determination that no further damage resulted. For those who experienced or observed these early attacks, the initial reaction was heartening. No doubt the Japs counted heavily on shattering American morale with their suicide rough weapons. I remember asking Admiral McCain whether he planned to abandon the following day's program because of damage to some of our ships. Characteristically, he snorted, "Why, hell no, son. You don't think these suiciders can stop us, do you?" The Admiral's attitude quickly permeated the press. The next day, we pushed even closer to the coast of Luzon.
About a dozen kamikaze planes attempting to reach the fleet. None got through.
In connection with the carrier forces, I date the failure of the Jap suicide tactic to the moment when Admiral McCain, one of our truly great naval leaders, exploded any possibility of retirement to lick our wounds. New dispositions were made in the task force formation. Anti-aircraft fire was grouped in such a way that even if a suicide plane broke through the fighting screen, its chances of reaching any of the ships were slim. A terrific concentration of firepower would blast the interloper to bits before he knew what happened. Jap desperation increased, however, to the extent that suicide pilots were no longer instructed to be particular in their choice of targets. Tokyo's orders were to crash land on any ship in sight, regardless of size or type. This all-out employment of human projectiles was increased during the Navy storm zone, when a number of small units of the 7th Fleet were crippled and a few sunk. After the Army conquered the range and established air bases on Leyte, most of these enemy craft were repulsed. Then came the Lingayen landings of January the 9th. This was the last opportunity to save the Philippines for the Japs. One after another, kamikaze pilots took off from Manila Fields, circled in the hills above the Gulf, and swooped down units of the landing force. Everything from destroyers and transports to battleships and deep carriers were subjected to this attack. More of our ships were sunk, but nothing the enemy could do prevented the landing. Up to and including that time, it was reliably estimated that a ridiculously low percentage of suiciders actually landed on our ship. All the rest was splashed by Navy airmen, Army pilots, or by gun crews. Despite the failure in January,
January to halt the liberation of the Philippines,
the Jap High Command was obdurate. As Vice Admiral McCain once told me, the Japs are such damn dumbbells that they are throwing away the war months in advance. In planning the invasion of Okinawa, so much closer to metropolitan Japan, Vice Admirals Turner and Mischer, together with Admiral Spruance, made full allowance for Jap stupidity. These leaders correctly assumed the Japs would continue to throw away thrones and pilots in attempting to stem our progress. And little more than a week ago, 5 days after the initial landing, the enemy sent about 500 planes south against our service forces. Of these, more than half must have been intercepted by Admiral Mischer's carrier pilots. The bulk of the rest ran afoul of Admiral Turner air defense screen. Others, and there were only a few of them, which reached the transport area off the landing beaches, were victims of expert naval gunnery. The fraction of enemy planes which succeeded in diving on ships was so negligible as to be hardly worth mentioning. Some of our smaller ships were sunk. It would be foolish to minimize the losses we have suffered during the past 6 months of Jap suicide tactics. Our ships have been damaged, and many of our sailors and officers have met death through blast burns or drowning. But, as Fleet Admiral Nimitz points out, never have we been thrown off balance as a result of these attacks. Our pressure on the Japanese homeland has mounted according to schedule. Our capture of strategic island approaches has proceeded according to plan. Our inexorable calendar of events to come has remained unaltered since it was set up following the invasion of the Marianas. The Japanese word kamikaze is of ancient origin. Literally translated, it means the divine wind. It evokes deep responses in the superstitious makeup of this race of egotistical fanatic warlords. For more than 6 months, the Jap warlords have pushed well off the way of their divine wind pilots against the men of the American Navy. The one unquestionable result has been that the countergale of American arms and American courage has mounted to ever greater proportions. Today, an American hurricane of tragic consequence for Japan is nearing the shrinking homeland of Emperor Hirohito. These events, the late President Roosevelt, who set them in motion, will not be privileged to follow to their logical conclusion. Yet he was confident of that conclusion, for he knew from the record that American Navy seamanship and airmanship had passed the test. This is Leslie Nichols speaking from Okinawa. I return you to the United States.